I was thinking about this very subject this weekend. A church that forgets where it has been is a church that does not know where it's going. A church that remembers where it's been is a church that knows where it's going. Christianity is an historic faith. It is a faith rooted in history, actual events, and that means that history has a special place for the Christian. You know, you can be a Buddhist and be ignorant of history and of Buddhist history. You could even, one might argue, be a Muslim and be largely ignorant of the history of Islam. You cannot be a Christian and be ignorant of Christian history. You would be ignorant of the very heart and center of the Christian faith. You would also be ignorant of a great number of other things and of your church, because the church exists not only here and now, it exists in history. We are united with the saints from today and from yesterday and in the future. We're going to talk about Christianity from Pentecost to the destruction of Jerusalem. That only covers about 40 years from AD 30 to AD 70, but it's some of the most important of the years of the early church. We'll be talking with Dr. Ted Byfield, general editor of the Christian History Project, here in the first hour of Issues, Etc. I'm looking forward to this because history is one of the things that just endlessly fascinates me, so much more than dates and names and places. A little bit after that, in the second hour of the program, Dr. Bill Hinson of the Confessing Movement within the United Methodist Church will join us to reflect upon the General Conference of the United Methodist Church held over the last 11 days and some of the decisions that were made there. Most lately, we have heard about the Methodists proposing and then rejecting the idea of an amicable split over the issue of homosexuality. We'll talk about that, among other things, with Dr. Bill Hinson. Now, from 4:30 to 5:30, it's open lines for your questions and your comments. As always, anything that you want to talk about. But I have a couple questions, given the fact that yesterday was Mother's Day. Did you kiss your mother, Craig? Did you tell her, thank you for being my mother? Thank you for taking care of me. You're a good son. You're the good son. I imagine Frankie, your brother, probably did the same thing. I want to ask mothers a question. What is the most challenging thing, not about being a mother, because there's so many challenges, what is the most challenging thing about being a Christian mother? Now, you don't have to be the mother of small children to answer that question. You can have gotten your kids up and out of diapers and out of the house long ago and still have a very good answer to that question. During open lines, what's the most challenging thing about being a Christian mother? Also, since torture is in the news, since the abuses in the Iraqi prisons is in the news, I want to revisit a question we had during open line sometime back near, closer to 9/11. When I asked the question about whether or not torture would be justified if it meant getting valuable information that would thwart the plans of terrorists and those who would do us harm. We'll talk about that during open lines as well. Then, let's see what comes up after that. Get back on track here. At about 5:15, a little bit into that third hour of the program, Pio De Sileni will join us to talk about the FDA's rejection last week on Thursday of that over-the-counter contraceptive called Plan B. They said it can't be sold over-the-counter. It must remain, at least for the time being, a prescription drug. Pio De Sileni of the Family Research Council will join us. And then, to round off today's program from 5:30 to 6, Jennifer Roback Morse, author of the book Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Does Not Work. We'll talk to her about motherhood and the development of a baby's brain. She says that the future of society hinges upon what mothers are doing with their children in the first few years of life. That's a pretty big statement. We'll find out what she means in the third hour of Issues, Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. During the first hour, we'll talk about Christianity from Pentecost, 30 A.D., to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. Dr. Ted Byfield is our guest. He's been a journalist for 55 years. He's founder and publisher of a Canadian national news magazine called The Report. He's general editor of the Christian History Project. It's a five-year project of publishing a series of 12 volumes. The first is out, of church history. Today, we're going to discuss the opening volume titled Under the Veil. Dr. Byfield, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, I certainly feel welcome and honored because I'm not a doctor. I'm a journalist.
All right.
And somebody said you're the opposite of a doctor.
Ted, then let's make the case initially that Christian history and history in general is important and is something worth not only learning sometime back in the past, but something that Christians ought to be engaged in even today and every day.
Well, I think you in your introduction certainly put it well. The point is that Christianity itself rests upon an historic event. You know, there were many, many religions that that actually had a god that walked the earth, but all of these things happened in those religions at a remote time in the remote past. Nobody can put a date on it. And yet our faith starts off in the Gospel of Luke saying, when so-and-so was the governor of Syria and somebody else was governor in Jerusalem, much as we might say, you know, when Lyndon Johnson was president and so on, Christianity is rooted in historic fact, and this makes it a very real thing. One of the things, I don't want to get onto another subject, but one of the things that I think that Gibson was trying to do with that movie is say, look, this really happened. It was hideous, but it really happened. This is what went on. And I think you have it, you say it well when you mention that a Christian has to take history very, very seriously, because these events have about them a reality that affects what we do now. We should decide what we do now on the basis of what we learned in the past. We should decide what we do not do now, or ought not to do now, on the basis of mistakes we've made in the past. So that just as the memory serves the individual, just as you and I are to a large degree governed in what we do today by what happened to us yesterday, so with Christianity, so with Christian history.
Ted, let's talk about, in general, those 40 years that will be the subject for this hour, from 30 to 70 A.D., in terms of the way an historian evaluates the evidence, the data, everything that comes before us that tells us about those years. How solid is our footing historically when we talk about those years from 30 to 70 A.D. in terms of Christian history?
The answer is, from a purely historical point of view, we're exceedingly solid. Because the historian, as an historian, wants chiefly to know, was this document, narrative, whatever it was this written within a time of the event it describes to be reliable? That is, if the Bible were written 200 or 300 years after the events that it describes in the life of Jesus, well, then it would not be anything like as reliable as if it were written within the lifespan of people who could actually have seen this. Now, the historian, that's one of his chief concerns, are these documents credible in terms of when they were written? And what's happening is, all through the 20th century, though very little notice was paid to it in the media, one discovery after another affirmed the early dates of the New Testament, making those stories much more historically credible than they had previously were thought to be. Now, you get a lot of people say, well, you know, I don't believe this stuff because Jesus is reported to be performing miracles, and I don't believe in miracles, therefore they're not historically sound. Well, if you reject miracles as such, then you're perfectly valid in rejecting Jesus. But that's not on historical grounds. That's on theological grounds, and that's a very different thing. Historically, we're on solid earth.
And in terms of the volume of the evidence that a historian would look at, compare it to other events that are placed in this level of antiquity.
Well, the Christians themselves naturally leave most of the information that's there. They would be the people logically expected to do that. Well, a lot of critics will say to us, well, you know, all those, most of your records are left by Christians. Well, what would you expect? I mean, most of the early records of the Communist Party, say, of the United States, are left by communists. Well, what does this make them, render them somehow or other unbelievable? Certainly not. So that while it's true that the great body of our faith is left by our own people, why not? It's also true that an increasing reference to those events from non-Christian sources continues to turn up. Archaeological evidence, for example, or evidence from other contemporary commentators at that time. So We're on good grounds historically, and the media, of which I'm part, the media have left have left the impression that whereas 200-300 years ago, people were able to believe this stuff, but modern investigation has shown that it's not reliable. The very reverse is true. If modern investigation has done anything at all, it is has served to affirm the reliability of the New Testament and Christian events of that time.
Can we put our fingers on dates of the significant things, such as, can we date the birth of Christ? Can we date his crucifixion and resurrection? Can we date Pentecost to an accurate year, to the scattering of the Jewish church, the conversion of Paul, his first, second, third missionary journeys, the death of the significant individuals, James and Paul? Can we actually place those accurately on a timeline with dates?
With Paul, we can become a lot more accurate than we can with Jesus himself, because we're not sure of the date in which he was born. Some say 4 B.C., that means 4 years before Christ was Christ born, and others place the date in that vicinity. But by and large, I think most people put the date of his death and the resurrection in 31 A.D. But it's not as though somebody was keeping score on that in that point, like as most other contemporary documents at that time regarding almost any movement. It's very, very difficult to put a specific date on it. Even government affairs are sometimes, you see the historians saying, well, this may have happened in 45 A.D., but then so-and-so thinks, no, it happened in 40 A.D. Somebody else thinks 46 A.D. Well, all those, that's a typical historical argument. So the answer is, we cannot precisely date the birth or death of Jesus, but based upon the evidence, we can come pretty close in assuming it must have been in or immediately around the year 31 A.D. Now, at the same time, the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. is highly verifiable because the Roman army was involved, and it kept far more specific records of major events, naturally. So that as to the dates of Paul, there was a major persecution in Rome. There's reason to believe that Paul certainly was in Rome at the time of his death. Also, I think most people today are satisfied, most historians are satisfied, that Peter was probably there. So it's likely that they died in the Neronian persecution, which was the first organized suppression of Christianity in Rome. I believe that it's in the mid-60s. I can't remember. I should remember, but I don't. I think 64, but I'm not sure. So that the arguments as to dates and that kind of thing are precisely what one would expect of a movement that was not really an official movement of government, but is nevertheless widely documented. So Christians can believe, while we're not quite sure of the date of his birth, 31 for his death, mid-60s for Paul's death and Neronian persecution, 70 A.D. definitely for the destruction of Jerusalem.
And why is 70 A.D. kind of the terminus of this first segment?
Because, you see, up until that time, Christianity was essentially a Jerusalem-based religion, which would have made it very much a Jewish religion. Now, some can argue quite convincingly that it's still a Jewish religion, in the sense that that's its origins. But what happens in 70 is that the entire Jerusalem-based ancient Jewish establishment is simply liquidated. And not only Christianity, but Judaism itself had to find another home somewhere, and so did we, so that it's a very significant time. It's as though God served notice on us at this point. I am no longer. Are we going to be a geographically centered religion? The Son of Man hath nowhere to lay his head. In many respects, neither did the Christians, and this thing, the spirit of mine is going to go everywhere. So, to center it in a kind of city-centered religion was all very well in the early order. It's not the way this one's going to work. We ought to bear that in mind when major Christian shrines. Rome, for instance, is one example. Constantinople was another one. These things could, you know, they could disappear. They could be blown apart. And that's very much what happened in 70 A.D.
Ted Byfield is our guest. He has been a journalist for 55 years. He's founder and publisher of a Canadian national news magazine called The Report. He's also general editor of the Christian History Project. It's a five-year project of publishing a series of 12 volumes of church history. Today we're discussing the opening volume, Under the Veil, which covers 30 A.D., to 70 A.D. If you have a question or a comment, our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The Gospels, at least several of them, are rather interesting in terms of their history, along with the Book of Acts, in naming the names of people that help us triangulate on some of the dates and some of the places. Let's talk about Pontius Pilate as a figure of history who just so happens in God's providence, gets mentioned and has a role to play in the most significant event in Christian history, the crucifixion of Christ.
Yes, he sort of goes down in history. There are a lot of Christians in many, many churches still say the creeds every week, and poor old Pontius Pilate gets named again. He's probably the best known official of the entire Roman Empire in terms of what most people have heard about. And he was actually a rather minor governor in a problematic province, and we talk about him week after he suffered under Pontius Pilate. The man, you know, he wasn't the worst of the people involved in the execution of Jesus, but he certainly takes the hit. But he's thoroughly historical. I mean, we know that there was a governor, and his name was Pilate, and he was in Jerusalem at that time. So there's no question that he played a part in what went on, and the existing accounts are probably very, very reliable authority on what happened.
Now, am I right that for some time archaeologists and historians had some doubts as to whether or not Pilate was just something that the gospel writers and a character that they made up, that he was not, there was no real hard and fast evidence for his existence?
I think we have to be careful, Todd, when people say, we don't say it, but when you hear other people say, well, experts say this, or archaeologists say that, or biblical scholars say the other. Very, very few archaeologists that I've ever read about doubted that Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea at the time that we say he was. But you'll always get somebody who's an archaeologist who's skeptical and says this, and they get a lot of print in the media. But by and large, there's never been serious doubt that Pilate was governor, was the Roman proconsul in Jerusalem at the time of the crucifixion. Now, since then, we find other evidence, archaeological evidence and textual evidence coming to life that makes it beyond any doubt. But I think all Christians have got to be very careful when people say, well, scientists think this. Some scientists may think this, and other scientists may think something quite different. And the media, particularly newspapers, are bad at that. They get two or three people that claim that something or other has been discovered when it hasn't been discovered, and or else that it's monumentally significant and it isn't. So that biblical criticism, for instance, now the people criticizing and challenging the authenticity and reliability of the New Testament gets an enormous press through the Jesus Seminar and so on. And we're always made to think that scholars, quote, scholars, are skeptical about all these events, whereas faithful people, you and me, aren't. Well, there's just as many scholars think as faithful people do as there are those that don't. So that scholarship as such is very, very rarely as skeptical as it's often presented in newspaper accounts, that sort of thing.
In a similar way, the other leaders that are mentioned, especially those mentioned in the latter part of the book of Acts, when we have Festus and Felix, these are the ones that deal with Paul during his arrest. And I want to talk about Paul a little bit later after the break. Do those also serve to help us triangulate on where these events take place in history?
Oh, yeah.
Ground them, root them in history?
Oh yeah, these things are appearing in these names appear in secular history, in the Roman accounts of what went on. You see, Josephus is very important. He's the Jewish historian of that period, who's a contemporary of those events, these people mentioned in the Pauline epistles and in the Gospels. He frequently refers to, and he isn't Christian. So why is he doing it? He's referring to them because they happen to have been in office at that time. He adds other things, you know. I mean, that story that is carried on the death of James, the brother of Jesus, you know, the account of how that man died, now that appears in secular history. It's in Josephus. How did he die? Well, he was very, very much respected in the temple in Jerusalem. See, they threw the other Christians out, Peter and the apostles. They got rid of them because they were causing trouble, but they couldn't get rid of James because people had such admiration for him. He's a very, very holy man, and he was Christian. He was, and he said he was, and he brought people to the Messiah, who was his brother, and his kinsman anyway, and he was... they finally said, well, they got rid of everybody else. They put the other James, the brother of John, to death. So they said, well, now, look, they say to him, we want you to get up to the very top of the temple at the Passover when there are thousands of people way below you, and we want you to tell us and announce that your brother was a fraud, that he was not the Messiah, that he did not rise from the dead, and that, by and large, the man was evil. Say that, and we'll allow you to continue living. Otherwise, we're going to put you to death right now. So, to their some astonishment, he said, oh, I'll go up there. Then that's fine. I'll do it. So the great moment comes. There's thousands of people there. He goes to the very top where he can see everybody. They're all below him. They're all looking up at him way up there. And he starts to speak, and he said, Jesus was the Messiah. Jesus rose from the dead. Jesus died for our sins. We have put to death the Messiah because we didn't recognize who he was. He went on like this. It was a magnificent witness to the Christian faith. He double-crossed them. And they just grabbed him and hurled him off, and he went flying down to the bottom, and he was almost not quite dead when they get him, and they beat him to death on the floor of the below the pinnacle. Now, that's not in the Bible. And yet, the man that it's about wrote the Epistle of James, and certainly is mentioned in the Acts of the Apostles. Now,
Ted, let's take a break here. I want to pick up right where we have to leave off here before this break when we come back. Ted Byfield has been a journalist for 55 years. He's general editor of the Christian History Project. Find out more about it at ChristianHistoryProject.com, ChristianHistoryProject.com.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, etc.
Jesus tells his opponents in John chapter 5, "You search the scriptures because you think that by them you have eternal life. These are the scriptures that testify about me." What did Jesus mean? Our Issues, etc. book of the month for May is titled, "Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center." It's written by Issues, etc. regular guest Pastor Daniel Preuss. For more information on the book, visit our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section. Why I Am a Lutheran is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. What does it mean that Jesus is the Alpha and the Omega? Find out with Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center, by Pastor Daniel Preuss. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Why I Am a Lutheran, our Issues, Etc. book of the month for May.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on finding Christians who will serve with passion and purpose by teaching overseas. In China and Vietnam, students are eager to have Americans teach them business or conversational English. Sharing your knowledge of those subjects allows you to let your care for others shine while making lifelong friends. The mission agency TeachOverseas.org provides all the training, so you don't even need a teaching degree. Even though the Chinese and Vietnamese governments are communist, they're eager to find qualified teachers who will instruct high school and college-age students professionally while taking a personal interest in them. Christians are needed to fill the many teaching positions that are now available. Pray that people who love Christ will respond and serve with purpose and passion by teaching overseas in China, Vietnam, or other countries. Get more information by logging on to the website teachoverseas.org. That's teachoverseas.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Here's something that troubles me, and it has for a long time. You've got, let's call him Joe, an over-the-road truck driver. A good guy, but not a scholar. Same for Sue. Just out of college, a new grade school teacher, puts in long hours at low pay. Fred, a bit beyond middle age, wrapping up his career in the corporate world. People like most of us. Last week it was reported that parents are seeking help from an infertility lab for their children who have leukemia. The lab artificially fertilizes mature eggs. Each embryo is then tested to see if it has genes that might help fight that leukemia. If it does, that embryo is implanted in a uterus, a baby born, and the stem cells from the umbilical cord are transplanted into the sick sibling. Unused embryos are stored, probably to be discarded. Ethical? An opinion poll reported 61% said it's okay. People like Fred and Sue and Joe and the rest of us casually pronouncing what we think is right. On every hand, we face tough issues. I don't have the answers, but I do fear following poll numbers. We need to raise the best and brightest young people to study and research for us all the right solutions to perplexing dilemmas. I pray that Mother's Day is not over.
God, who created us, knows that if we ever do anything that He truly is pleased with, it's only because He's doing it through us. Even as a Christian, there's nothing you can do in order to get on God's good side. And the reason for that, understand what your relationship with God is. The reason you are saved is because of a relationship that God has created. He has adopted you into His family.
Law and Gospel, weekday evenings at 6:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Coming up in 25 minutes on Issues, Etc., Dr. Bill Hinson of the Confessing Movement within the United Methodist Church will be our guest to reflect upon the General Conference of the United Methodist Church that took place in Pittsburgh. It might be going on. They might be wrapping it up here, but it was an 11-day conference every 4 years. They made some very significant decisions that made headlines, and we'll talk with Dr. Bill Hinson about that in about 25 minutes. Stay tuned for that. Tomorrow on the program, a roundtable discussion on women and vocation. Our guests will be Kathy Schultz, Linda Preuss, and Sally Henriksen. That's in the second hour of Issues, Etc. tomorrow, so tune in for that as well. Now, in the first 25 minutes, we have been walking through the history of Christianity, just a very small segment from 30 A.D. to 70 A.D., covering some of the high points and talking about, well, quite frankly, the historical veracity, how deep the roots of history go in the claims of Christianity, especially those significant years from 30 to 70 A.D. If you have a question or a comment on Christianity during that time, call during the next 25 minutes, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Ted Byfield is our guest. Ted, I had to cut you off there at the bottom of the hour before we went to our break. You were in the midst of kind of bringing your point home about James, the half-brother of Jesus, and how what we know of his death in Jerusalem, his assassination, does not come from Scripture, but comes from a very well-respected source outside the Bible. Pick up where you left off.
Well, I think that it sort of follows from your question. Are other historians, or other sources affirming the Christian experience? And the answer is certainly they are, and sometimes they almost fulfill or finish off a story that has not appeared in the Bible, as in the case of the death of James, the brother of Jesus. But they there are a great many other things we could mention. You know, the pool in Jerusalem, for instance. One of the ways they used to attack the fourth gospel was that there was no such pool, and so on. And an archaeological dig, something like 30 or 40 years ago, found it, and things like that keep turning up. So that what is really happening is that archaeology and scholarship is providing an increasing credibility to the New Testament, while the popular media is suggesting the opposite. And it makes me angry because, as I mentioned earlier, I am part of the popular media. And I think we've messed up the coverage of religion pretty badly right through the 20th century.
Let's go to the phones. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Ron is listening in California on the Internet. Ron, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks. I'm happy to talk to you. I knew Ted years ago. I actually worked for him years ago.
Ron. Been,
yeah.
Ron, what's your question or comment?
Yes, I wanted to ask Ted if he has any knowledge of whether, you know, with the Passion movie today, if there is any kind of reaction in the first century about the brutality and the unfairness of Jesus' trial and crucifixion.
It's a good question, Ron. Thank you very much. How did it play in that day, or do we have any indication from history?
Well, the one thing, there's two questions there, is how did people respond? The answer is they did not respond in any startling way at all, because what happened to Jesus was a routine method of execution, which the Romans did not hesitate to practice on a wide scale, much wider than the three on Calvary. There was a that form of execution. They'd sometimes put hundreds of men to death on that same basis, and they always did it as a public spectacle because it was intended to terrify people. That was the whole purpose of it, and it certainly did. There is one witness to these things. A woman writes, "The thing I can't stand is the screaming of the men and being put to death." And so it was a hideous thing, but no, it was the experience of Jesus was no more hideous than the others that occurred. So naturally, there wasn't any special response to that, except from his own followers, of course, and we are still responding to it. But as to the fairness of the trial, the prisoner was condemned out of his own mouth. And that was stretching the Jewish law quite considerably, as it would our law. And that's a tradition, you see, in almost most codes, that you cannot plead guilty to a capital offense. I don't think you can in any of the American states. You certainly can't in the British tradition of law. You can't plead guilty to murder if murder involves capital punishment, because they don't want a man to be able to use the court system to commit suicide. You see, we have to prove them. And what they did with Jesus, what the high priest did, was put him under oath and then say, "Who are you?" And his answer was that "I am," which is the death to even mention the word, applies it to himself and announces himself as judge of the, really, of the universe. So the high priest ritually tears his clothes and says, "I've heard blasphemy." And he had heard blasphemy. Unless it's true. Now, these two things, I think Gibson brought that out. But so many people are horrified by the event itself. But that's because we have colored it. You know, I've seen the crucifixion scenes in church windows and so on are always rather noble. You know, it was just a dusty, sordid, hideous business. And Gibson reminded us of this fact, and I think that was a wonderful thing to have done, because you know, a lot of people don't wear a cross around their neck, you know, just as a trinket. Now, that particular event that he described is what that trinket is about, and so it makes people think, and I think that was a good thing.
How significant was Saul's conversion? And where, as an historian, would you put it in terms of the date? This is something that's always eluded me a little bit because there's not a real sound reference there in the book of Acts. And then Paul, when he tells his story several times, puts a lot of years in there. Where would we put it, and how significant was this conversion of Saul?
I'm going from memory, Todd, since it's been some time since I edited that copy, but it strikes me that his conversion must have occurred sometime in the 30s or early 40s, because it's obvious that he did quite a bit of, as you say, traveling and thinking before he actually began his ministry. Then he goes to Jerusalem, he speaks to James, who's the bishop, and to Peter, and then he launches forth. So that I think we tried within the volume to put dates on most of that stuff.
You said about 33 A.D. at one point.
Well, that in that case, I think we're too early, because if the resurrection was in 31, he has to have had time to conduct his. He was a real ideological tormentor. There was no doubt about him. He reminded me, and I think we put that in the book. The guy in Dr. Zhivago, who's the terror of the people. Paul was like this. He was an ideological crusader with a vicious streak, and he makes no secret of this. That must have absorbed some years. So we get up into the late 30s before there's any change, and I don't think there's any doubt about the change. I mean, he was something happened to him, and well, what? Well, probably the record of the event itself and the Acts of the Apostles and his own memory of it. It's the best likelihood of what occurred, and all of a sudden, this man who was the chief tormentor of the Christians becomes their chief advocate, and as they say, the rest is history. But it's an amazing story. I mean, this man was he was really something, and there was a certain humanness to Paul. I mean by that frailty to Paul that does not occur in Jesus. I mean, Paul gets mad at people, and Paul makes mistakes, and Paul calls people down, and when Paul's a human being. He's the stuff that you and I are made out of. And that, to my mind, that makes him fascinating as a person. And the epistles themselves, his letters, are so profound in terms of their assessment of human nature and how it acts and what the conditions of serving Christ will be, what we can expect to happen within ourselves. All of this is manifested in that book. That man. Well, he's kind of the central actor in our volume one, as he ought to be, but we tried to treat him not the biblical figure. He wrote so much of the Bible, but we've tried to get at him as a human being, what he was like in if you'd known him, and what comes out of that is a very, very gripping, fascinating man.
And his missionary journeys, we tend to think of these in modern terms because we travel so thoughtlessly and so easily distances in the course of a day. I drive 30 miles to work and then back again, a 60-mile round trip that would have taken Paul 3 days probably to travel. Tell us a bit about those missionary journeys.
As long as he was on the main roads, the Roman roads, he was okay. But if you look at where he went, a lot of the places he obviously went to were not on main roads. The minute you got off the main roads, there were all sorts of hazards. There was thieves, for one thing, as the story of the Good Samaritan was told by Jesus. Well, that's because people did get beaten up when they were traveling back roads. But when there's a marvelous account of traveling the back roads of Asia Minor and Palestine and Syria at that time, and the big hazard were dogs, because everybody, the people living out in the country, were constantly subject to brigands. So they made it a point of keeping ferocious dogs that were trained to attack anybody who was going along the road that was a stranger. And the reason being that 9 times out of 10, that stranger was in danger. He might be a stranger that comes and beats you up and robs you. so that as you went along the road, these animals would rip out at you. And he, well, there's no mention of this in the New Testament, but it's one of the things that Paul routinely had to put up with. The other place is a place when he's moving from Corinth to from Athens to Corinth, he has to go by around a walk on the that overlooks the sea, and it was just infested with robbers at that point that would take people, rob them, and then hurl them off into the water, and that was the end of them. And he passes by this, he goes here, he goes there, and we think of him, you know, as though he were traveling on United Airlines or something. It wasn't like that at all. And the conditions under which, you know, they'd say he sailed from here to there, for instance, well, the ships, people sat out on deck, and when the spray came over, you got soaked. And they were small vessels with 200 or 300 people aboard them, and quite often people drowned. It was, ships sank, or else they were washed overboard. The waves would come over. The hazard of just simple travel. We've detailed it in the book, and it certainly makes you think. You know, what this man went through, and he makes something of this. You know, he'll say, three times was I shipwrecked, or whatever it was. Well, he's talking about somebody that has really experienced life in the raw, and it makes when you know of these things and you can read of these things, it makes the whole picture in the Acts of the Apostles and in the epistles much more vivid, and your admiration for this fellow really goes up.
We're talking about Christianity from Pentecost to the destruction of Jerusalem. That's 30 A.D. to 70 A.D. Our guest is Ted Byfield, general editor of the Christian History Project, a five-year project to publish 12 volumes of church history. Today we're discussing the opening volume, Under the Veil, that deals with that time period from 30 to 70. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Kevin is on the line. He calls from Ladue. Kevin, thank you for waiting, and welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Quick question. How did Paul become an apostle?
Thank you, Kevin. Ted?
Well, he lists himself among the apostles because I think the criterion was it not that they had seen him. They had known him, and he knew Jesus and through his experience on the road to Damascus. And he puts himself in that position. He appoints himself, as it were, with the authorization of the council they had at Jerusalem. They commission him to make this missionary journey. Later on, there's some doubt about whether they should have done it because there was a controversy over his ministry. People were beginning to attack it because he seemed to be attacking the Jewish law, but. I think he considers himself commissioned by Jesus directly, and it's hard to believe that he wasn't, because subsequently he appears to have been intended to do what he did. I remember an old pastor we used to have always speculated on whether the Christians actually jumped the gun on Matthias when the man they elected to. Take the place of Judas, and if we were always in such a hurry to get everything done, you know, maybe, he said, this pastor used to say, maybe Paul was the designated successor for Judas, because Judas, by all accounts, was a very, very clever man, and so was Paul. However, that's speculation, that's not theology.
And a question that is, at least on the historical record, we have Paul's account told numerous times in the New Testament, of Christ, the risen Christ's appearance there, calling him to be an apostle. It is recognized by the church, and as Ted says, history bears out Paul's claim of what he saw there, because he does, in fact, become the apostle to the Gentiles. A couple things before we have to wrap up our conversation. Let's talk a little bit about Emperor Nero, who, at least by our best estimates, is the one who instigates, intentionally or unintentionally, the persecution in which the Christians find themselves at the wrong end of the persecution. And I also want to talk about the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. Tell us a bit, give us a thumbnail sketch of Nero.
Well, Nero was quite plainly mad. I don't think there's much doubt about that. And he uses the Christians. The Christians were a presence in Rome. They were not a major presence, but they were there. And the city had burned down, and he was being blamed for it, so he had to have somebody that he could blame for it. So he picks this little group up because they were handy, and they were Jewish, most of them, so that made them attractive, too, as villains, because anti-Semitism was way before Christianity. But the man was a monster, and then having arrested them, he burns them at the stake, along beside the Appian Highway. These are the activities of somebody who's nuts. But that element, we must remember, is in everybody, because mobs, when they get wild, sometimes even Christian mobs, will do awful things. So that's what he was. That's what he turns out to be. The lasting, what would you call it, danger that he committed was that he made it illegal to be a Christian. And that stayed on the books, and we later suffered a whole lot because of that. The Romans did not ordinarily prohibit any faith, and they did the Christian faith. So that's who he was, and he provides the Christians with their first terrible experience of persecution, and that experience is going to be repeated again and again and again for 300 years. Which, of course, we tell about in successive volumes. But that was government. Government can become dangerous, and to Christianity has frequently. And we should always be careful of government. I don't mean that it's always bad. It's quite good, according to in many instances. But bad people can take part in government.
One more call before we wrap up our conversation. Hazel is calling from St. Louis. Hazel, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. I'm on a cell phone, and my mother was telling me yesterday that Paul was the same age as Jesus. Is that true?
It's a good question.
I don't think so. I think he would have to be somewhat younger, but it's speculation. Because, you see, he dies in 65 and if A.D. or thereabouts, and if Jesus had lived to that for another, what would that be, 32 years, he would have been a very old man. So I think it's likely that Paul was probably 10 years younger, but it's just a guess. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with speculating on these things, as your mother's doing. I think that's a good thing because it makes us realize there was real people involved here. But as long as we don't reach conclusions that aren't hard and fast, because you have to have the better evidence than we have in that particular question to do that. One thing I wish you could do, Todd, and that is tell people how to get these books, because we don't sell them in stores. And if you can put that 1-800 number on, we'd certainly appreciate it.
Okay, we'll get to that here in the very last few minutes of our conversation. Let's come to 70 AD then, with only about 3 or 4 minutes. Why did Rome besiege Jerusalem and eventually destroy the city and the temple entirely?
The immediate cause was the fact that there was a nationalist guerrilla movement in existence in Jerusalem at the time that Jesus' ministry was taking place. When we get to the year 70 AD, that movement takes hold of the city. It finally gets in power, as it were. It massacres the Roman garrison in Jerusalem. Having told them they'd be safe, they then kill them. And, of course, you couldn't play with Rome like this. Rome sent two armies against them eventually. I think there were 6 legions involved. They were surrounded the city, and when they were able to force it, starve it out, really, after people were reduced to cannibalism, they then moved in on it and just left, as Jesus said they would, they left practically no one stone upon another. And it was simply obliterated, and very, very little was left, and people have naturally moved out. And that event ends our first volume, because it also ends the old order of Judaism. It's over. we're now in a very, very new ball game, and that's the way Christianity begins.
Our guest, Ted Byfield, will be back on Issues Etc. Wednesday on the 19th of May to discuss Christianity from the fall of Jerusalem, that event that ends our conversation, to the Decian persecution. What other volumes are you planning on publishing, Ted?
We're working on the sixth now. The next, there will be 12 altogether. And the next one deals with the persecution of Christians, and the next one after that with the Christians win. You see, we become the official state, as it were, but that creates a whole bunch of new problems for us, quite different. And then the society as a whole collapses. That's another one, the destruction of the Roman Empire. And then you have, in Volume 5, which is now being printed, the rise of Islam. Very, very few people know this. Islam conquered nearly two-thirds of Christianity and in various ways coerced the population into becoming Muslim. The counter-strike of the Christians is called the Crusades, but it was a counter-attack. It was an attempt to regain what had been taken. It's important that we know that, too.
I look forward to future conversations with you on each and every one of those. Thank you very much, Ted Byfield, for being our guest.
Thank you.
Ted Byfield has been a journalist for 55 years. He's founder and publisher of a Canadian national news magazine called The Report. He's general editor of the Christian History Project. It's a five-year project to publish a series of 12 volumes of church history. We covered 30 to 70 on May 19th, Wednesday. Ted will be back with us. We'll talk about 70 AD to the Decian persecution. That toll-free number he mentioned before, 1-800-853-5402, is the number you can call to find out how you can get, volume by volume, these 12 volumes of the Christian History Project. 1-800-853-5402, 1-800-853-5402, or find out more on the web at www.christianhistoryproject.com, www.christianhistoryproject.com. When we come back from this break, we're going to spend some time with Dr. Bill Hinson. He's president of the Confessing Movement within the United Methodist Church, and it's the title of the movement is The Confessing Movement. He's a retired Methodist pastor. His thoughts on the General Conference of the United Methodist Church in Pittsburgh, the decisions they made about homosexuality, homosexual pastors, and whether or not that church, still one of the largest mainline Protestant denominations in the United States, whether or not that church will split or whether it will remain together, that comes up after this break when we come back. History, oh, those who forget it are doomed to repeat it. The worst thing is not being doomed to repeat it. The worst thing is forgetting it, folks. Because as Christians, when we forget our history, we cut ourselves off from the Christians who have come before us and their faith. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.